KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the 29th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. This year, performers include Tedeschi Trucks Band, Dr. Joan and the Night Trippers, Maceo Parker, a Prince tribute with Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, and many, many more, plus two after-hours parties, dance competitions, six cruises, and 4th of July fireworks. This year, everyone will need a pass to enter the festival. Single-day passes go on sale June 1st, and early bird pricing has been extended to June 5th at 11:59 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, July 1st through 4th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
I got my headphones on, just on the block. Not a moment to waste, cause I feel the bass drop.
Thanks for the times that you've given me. The memories are all in my mind. And now something I must say out loud. You once, twice, three times later, and I love. Yes, you once, twice, three times later, and I love you. I love you.
Good morning, and welcome to the June edition of Black Book Talk. We are honored this morning to have as our guest Dr. Margaret Ellen Mayo Talbert. I'm Patricia Welch, the library lady, one of the three co-hosts of Black Book Talk.
And O.B. Hill, let's read, walk, and talk.
And Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. This is Margaret.
Hi, welcome to the program. Welcome to the Portland metropolitan area where our listeners are, and actually at other sites throughout the state. It is wonderful to have you here. You are such an accomplished woman whose life, as they say, as Langston Hughes said, life for you has not been a crystal stair, but you have turned it into a diamond. Your book is called Resilience in the Face of Adversity, a Suffolkian's life story. I'm from Maryland, near Virginia, Suffolk, Virginia, but I hadn't heard that term before. Could you tell us why you chose to, tell us a little bit about your book and why you chose to include the and am I pronouncing it correctly, Suffolkian?
That's correct. That's the way I say it.
Okay, a Suffolkian's life story.
Well, why I decided to phrase it that way or choose that title.
Yeah.
I have had a number of adverse circumstances. I've been in a number of them. And here I am today, a retired woman. I won't tell you my age, but I'm retired.
Because you're a Southern woman. We don't tell all our business.
And I'm enjoying myself. I've enjoyed myself through life, but it hasn't all been pleasant. But out of all that has happened to me, I was able to pick myself up and move on. And I must admit that it wasn't all with my doing. I had a lot of help from a number of people that I say thank you to each of them who helped me along the way. And in today's terminology, we call them mentors. Mm-hmm. Role models and the like. And I always say to students that I, to whom I give advisement, to choose one or more mentors. And sometimes they'll choose you and seek their advice on whatever path you're choosing to take in life. So I decided to write this book in my retirement, and I've been retired since 2011.
Okay.
Initially, my thought was that I would put in writing information on my life and this would be for my son and my grandchildren. Because a lot of times, as you sit around the table and talk to them, they don't always retain what you tell them. So I said, if it's in a book, written down in a book, it'll be there for them to read at a later stage in their lives. But as I talked to people that I know, gave them sections of my manuscript to read, they said, well, what you have here is information that a lot of people would be interested in reading. And so I moved ahead and put it in published form.
Well, tell us this. How long did it take you to write this book?
Now, I didn't just sit and go through it A, B, C, D, and one stage after another, but it was first it was piecemeal. While I was working, as I came across ideas, it may have been one sentence, it may have been a paragraph, it may have been a letter that I received, I recorded it. I put it on my computer in a file. And when I retired, I thought I had a huge file. So I decided to organize it the way they teach us in school to have an outline. So I put it in the right format, outline, and then I started writing. As I completed a section, I identified someone who knew me, not totally, but who knew of me. For instance, one of my classmates in undergraduate school, one of the people that I met while, the classmate that I'm talking about is Robert Peebles, Jr., one of the persons who was a member of the Committee on Equal Opportunities in Science and Engineering, for which I served as executive liaison at the National Science Foundation. This member and I carried conversations quite a bit, so I chose her to review a section on my career that was relevant to the National Science Foundation. I called on my sisters and brothers to give me pointers or read what I had and ask me questions or tell me about scenarios or information that I may have left out. And so it just went along those lines. I even chose one of the people who accompanied me as a member of a team that I led to Ghana to participate and help lead the National Cancer Program discussion on the program for the entire country. And we were hosted by Professor Alate, who was then directing the Ghana Atomic Energy Commission. So I chose different people to look at different parts and read it, give their insights, information, feedback, and it came together quite easily. I would say, if I had to estimate the time, maybe a year. That's a long answer, but maybe a year.
About your siblings, I read that you were orphaned at an early age and you took care of your siblings. Were there grandparents around or other relatives to help?
Well, what happened was that my father and mother died early in their lives. And my mother died first. And in that period, we were not living in our original section of Suffolk. Our original section was called Saratoga. It was the colored section, as they called it then, of Suffolk, one of the many. And that, with the death of our mother and our father not being there because they had separated, he was in the original section of town. That meant that we didn't have anyone to take care of us. So we lived in about six or so different homes, people in the community trying to take care of six kids at one time. So we rotated so it wouldn't be a burden on the different families. And our grandmother came and got us. We were orphans. My grandmother came and got us. This is the mother of our father.
Uh-huh.
she picked us up and brought us into her home, where there were already a lot of cousins. So her house increased to about 13 or 14 people, mm-hmm. most of whom were kids. So when we went to school, we thought that we were all sisters and brothers. So it was difficult to have a teacher tell you that's not your brother, and your name is Mayo, not Bullock, or not Rollins. That kind of thing went on. Mm-hmm. But we enjoyed living with our grandmother. So there was a period when we were orphans. Then our grandmother died.
Oh.
And that left me and my two older sisters had gotten married and moved out of the home. So that left me to take care of my brother and two younger sisters. That I did for a while. And then I realized that, you could say, you know, how neighbors talk. Mention was made, well, we need to put them in an orphan home and that kind of thing. And we knew that the orphan home for blacks, well, the rumor was that it was like a detention center. And we didn't want to go there. So we packed all our things in the red wagon, and this was my brother's red wagon, and we walked across town with quite a distance to our older sister's house, where she and her husband and her kid lived. And we just moved in with them. At that time, we didn't have telephones around like what we have today, the cell phone and hand phone and all. So you manage. You show up at a person's house, and they would feed you and help take care of you. Everybody was very helpful. But our sister took us in. She was the cook in the family, and we knew we would have lots of good food.
You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, you know, by today's standards, Your beginnings were, really by any standards, being orphaned and moving from place to place. Very humble beginnings and probably very difficult, and yet exemplifying what it means when we say it takes a village to raise a child, and a reminder of a time when people did this without thinking. I'm sure there are many people who still do, but I mean, yeah. There was a time when it wasn't remarkable, it wasn't given much thought. It just, this is what you did. Now, exactly. What our listeners are probably saying, well, yeah, but we've heard about circumstances like that before. True. But what is remarkable is,
I doubt.
But the thing is, what you did with what you had. I am looking at your bio, and I am seeing the National Science Foundation. I'm seeing Argonne Laboratories. You were teaching and doing research at Tuskegee Institute. You have been around the world. So tell our listeners what you have done professionally, how you were able to rise above this, and what you were able to achieve for yourself, for your family.
Well, in my life, I like challenges. And my thing is, can I solve whatever the issue is and become successful? If I fail, then I just go a different route. Some people, when they fail, they give up. I never did. I sought out people to help me along life's path. So after earning my degrees, I have a bachelor's in chemistry with a minor in mathematics, a master's in analytical chemistry, and a PhD in biochemistry. With those degrees, I said, let's make it work for me. And it did. In a short span of time, I did get married. Actually, I got married twice. Okay. It didn't work. And I'm not laughing at, if you hear me laughing, it's just my way. I'm not laughing because my marriages didn't work. I'm laughing because you have to laugh sometimes rather than cry.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had been successful, but I wasn't, so I have to realize that and keep on going. And in the process, I ended up traveling all around the United States. As a matter of fact, you're in Portland, and I did go in and out of Portland as I was in charge of a project at the Oregon Health and Science University there.
Yes. Okay.
It was a science and technology center called CMOP, C-M-O-P, and it has partners, several partner institutions that are involved there, that are not all in Portland, but the center is a center for coastal margins and observations and predictions. And the interesting thing is, as I required and the foundation required, they had to have diversity in their makeup. the diversity in this center can you can understand is mostly the involvement of 5 tribes that are in charge of the river there.
Okay, yes.
And, of course, a number of the staff are of different races and ethnicity, but I found it very interesting how they worked with those 5 tribes. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do their study on coastal margins because the American Indians had charge of it. Anyway, getting back to what I was doing. So it, not just with that kind of work, that was one of 6 centers that I had charge of. I used my background because it is diverse in what it said. I rose to the level of being a generalist more so, not a general, but a generalist. Mm-hmm. But still a biochemist. But I moved into administration and management, and that's what I was doing with those 6 centers. In addition, whenever I assumed a position, it seems that my superiors always gave me more than one major responsibility. So at the National Science Foundation, I was in charge of the 6 science and technology centers that were in different places at major institutions around the United States, but also in charge of the National Committee on Equal Opportunities in Science and Engineering. So here I have at my disposal the opportunity to guide the making of rules and regulations on diversity and how to get them in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and to keep them there. And I'm also working on other fronts. So traveling I did. And other positions that I had before I was at the National Science Foundation was at British Petroleum Company. Oh. Very interesting. I had to do a fast learn because in business I learned that they move very fast, and it's not all about failures when they cut you out. It could be a success, but they want to move on to something else. But I was at a level there as a senior planner and a senior budgets and control analyst, and I ended up being the highest ranking African-American female there at the time, and I was at the research center at Warrensville Heights in Ohio. Now that company has moved to Chicago, Illinois. But the other successes I had was that I was director of the Division of Educational Programs at Argonne National Laboratory. This was 1990s that I was there for early to mid-90s, and I made sure that our people, minorities, not just African-Americans, but minorities, were given an opportunity there. And I'm not downing the laboratory, and I'm not saying that they would not have had opportunities, but greater numbers received opportunities while I was there, because we pressed the issue when the idea was brought up that, well, they don't know this or that when they come in. Well, we started a core program to orient the students before placing them to the various laboratories of the different scientists and engineers. And they were successful. And I didn't just leave them there standing. We checked on them. And when I said we, I had a staff with that. And also I had to diversify my staff. So that worked out good. And then while I was there at Argonne, I read in Science that there was a position open that call for a director of the New Brunswick Laboratory. Now, if you know about that, it's the Nuclear Analytical Chemistry Laboratory that's also in charge of safeguards. And I say, if you know about that, you probably don't, because it's a well-kept secret. This laboratory is a network laboratory of the International Atomic Energy Agency, so I had to go to Austria to participate in meetings where decisions are being made about nuclear materials and programs and training in those areas. And here I definitely used my chemistry a lot as I managed a staff, plus took care of leading the leadership on programs and activities of that type. And I was the first African-American female to serve as director of that laboratory. So, and the successes go on and on. Then I said, well, looking at my family, the Mayo family, descendants of Fanny and Benjamin Mayo of Suffolk, Virginia, I'm the first one to earn a doctorate degree. But since then, we've had 3 or 4 more to come through.
Excellent.
The tunnel.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Where is Argonne National Laboratories?
It's about 25 miles outside of Chicago. Matter of fact, it's so close that I lived in Chicago and drove out to Argonne each day of work.
We just do want to do a reminder that you're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO. Today we are interviewing Dr. Margaret Mayo Talbot, and we're talking about her book, well, her life, which has become a book called Resilience in the Face of Adversity. Sorry, Dr. Talbot, please continue.
It's okay. It's a laboratory that is, I'm trying to think of a city that it's near, but I think the best thing to do is just leave it at about 25 miles outside of Chicago.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, I was going to say, it is a laboratory of the Department of Energy. It's owned by the Department of Energy, United States Department of Energy, but it is operated by the University of Chicago.
You also had experience at Tuskegee. Could you mention a little bit about that?
That's my love. Yes, I graduated from Tuskegee with my undergraduate degree, and I always, ever since that time, I've kept my linkage there. After earning my master's degree, I got a position as a technician on the agricultural side of the campus. And while I was a technician, I was visited at the laboratory by the head of the Department of Mathematics at Tuskegee. And he invited me to become a faculty member in his department. And I thought about it for a while and then decided to join. But my interest was in getting into the faculty, but also becoming a chemistry faculty member. But there were no openings, so I decided to just stay with the math for a while. And while I was up there in math, teaching mathematics, I was visited by a recruiter from Brown University. And you see, that was during the time that major universities were recruiting minorities to help diversify their student body. I think it may have been a matter of funding from the federal government. If they didn't do it, they may have been cut or whatever. Something was pushing them to do it, not just Brown University, but all of the major universities. So I was among those recruited. And imagine this. I finally accepted the offer, and there were about 200 African Americans on the campus, and the student body was over 30,000.
Good night.
But we got to know each other, and it was the kind of thing where being determined that we were going to miss out, when we would see one another walking down the street and we had not met, you would see us as you've seen people as you walk by them, they continue to watch and turn as you walk past. That's the kind of thing that was happening with us. And then we would get together in groups and to go to activities like the movies and the like when there was a movie showing that was relevant to our race and or of interest in other ways. We would go, and then on campus there were a number of activities that were held, and also we would, in our living areas, we would have meals where everybody could bring dishes and potluck kind of thing. So we kept together as a group and supported each other that way, and that's where I met my second husband. Gone there with the intent of doing that. I went there to get a degree.
There's some folks who are going to get their MRS degree. I hear a lot about that, but you weren't going for that degree. Okay.
Right. But unfortunately, that didn't last long either. So after that, I went, after earning my degree and doing different things in terms of the job market, I had the opportunity to go to Belgium. And then when I came back from Belgium, I went back to Brown University. And while at Brown University, I was advised that the position of director of the Carver Research Foundation was available. This is the foundation that Dr. Carver established in 1940.
Is that George Washington Carver?
Yes, indeed. It is indeed. And I say that my link with him. Not that I'm as old as that, so don't think that. He died in 1943.
Well, no.
Oh, my gosh. I'm giving away some information that I shouldn't have.
Uh-oh.
I was born in 1943.
Now, see, we didn't ask. You told. Told on yourself.
I'm so sorry. My blabber mouth just kept flapping.
Look. We're at a point in life where we forget very easily. I'm sure our listeners do too. You are just a young thing. Whatever age you are, until you're 90, you are a young thing anyway, so don't even worry. Let's go on.
Now, since publishing this book, I have received an invitation from the National Park Service, which has designated a portion of Tuskegee University as a National Historic Site. Especially
great.
The Carver Museum.
Wonderful.
I think from the Carver Foundation now. Oh, I've been invited to come back there on August 2nd to make a presentation on my contributions to the Carver Research Foundation. And I have a lot to talk about.
Well, we believe you. We have about 4 minutes left. I mean, obviously, you are at least a one-hour interview. We unfortunately only have a 30-minute program. But I know that, you know, OB and I have been talking a lot. Emma, we're going to step back. Like you, Dr. Talbot, she's joining us by phone, so we can't give her eye contact. Emma, is there anything you want to ask before we go to watch it?
I am just fascinated with the story of your life. I don't even know you, and I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
Emma, is it okay if we do another question or?
Yes, please.
Okay. You've raised your son, and from what we read, very well. But so you were a single mother. You're going here, you're going there. You had high powered positions. How did you do this? Because he seems to have come out very, very well.
I had help. Whenever I needed to travel short term, when I was living in Tuskegee, the neighborhood people, sometimes it was his classmates, other times they were neighbors to where we live, and they would say, oh, bring that boy on here, and they would keep him. Now, my concern was that they would treat him as a guest, let him do what he wanted to do, and I am strict. When it comes to getting your lesson done and the like. So I was leery of that. I was also concerned that I was away so much that he was losing out a big part of what he needed to have in discipline. So he and I decided that we would find a boarding school for him. And we ended up selecting with him, making the final choice. We selected St. Paul in Covington, Louisiana. And mind you, I didn't leave him alone down there. I was down there every weekend. I had a break. Every holiday, there was a break and everything. So faculty meetings and the like, I was there for my son.
Well, it seems like he was a chip off the old block.
And now I mentor students. And since I retired, I was trying to get rid of them, but I can't seem to get rid of them. They still call me. They still send me these emails. And the early career adults do the same. So I give them advice. Decide on your path to take that you want to take. And if you're not good at decision making, make sure you seek the advice of others. And realize that whatever they tell you is just advice. It's not, they're not giving you orders. You're the one who knows everything about your situation. So you make the decision. And decide on what legacy you want to leave behind, but explore other areas. There are people who get into set areas and they say, oh, I'm going to be a physicist, and I don't need to know chemistry or whatever, but they're wrong. You need to explore as many options as possible and get prepared. And you can make a decision and realize that you can change it whenever you want. It's not,
that's
you
so
don't
true.
Have to be a woman to change your mind. You can change it.
Any day.
Be a leader.
You know something, Dr. Carver? I think you need to come on back to Portland, and not just to be on this radio show. We unfortunately have to close out because somebody's coming in behind us. But at any time, if you want to come to Portland, Oregon, there are venues that we can reserve and just have people hear your story. The reason why your students don't leave you alone is because they know they have an excellent mentor who's going to give them good advice throughout. So on behalf of Black Book Talk, I'm Patricia Welch, the library lady, saying thank you very much.
OB Hill.
You.
Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, my students all need to hear your message.
Yes.
Thank you.
So you've got Lionel Richie. It wasn't Lionel Richie a Tuskegee alum? I'm pretty sure he is.
Yes.
He is.
Yes, he is.
That's right. The Commodore started in a little shack off campus. So I know, and he has risen, and I know he would be so proud to call you, you know, his sister from Tuskegee. Thank you. We hope to see you soon.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay.
Bye-bye.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, June 2nd, 2016. Incoming Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has given corporate diversity a low grade. He says that more women, people of color, and LGBT people need to be added to corporate boards. Speaking as the current Oregon State Treasurer, Wheeler cited research that shows more diversity leads to better performance. Wheeler will become Portland's mayor in January. The announcement everyone has been waiting for, Portland's naked bicycle ride, will begin at Mount Scott Park in southeast Portland. The race draws 10,000 nude cyclists each year to Portland. This year's ride will begin Saturday, June 25th. Who is starting the fires at Vancouver's churches? The Clark County Fire Marshal's Office is putting up $20,000 in reward money for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the arsonists. Investigators think that one person or group started the three fires. Fires were set at First United Congregational Church of Christ, May 25th, Liberty Bible Church of the Nazarene on the next day, and the former Bethesda Slavic Church this